عام بعد عامين وجيت ورمت في آلة التصوير 20 حديقة وعصافير الجليل وعصافير.
Listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM and streaming online at kboo.fm.
New year, new KBOO. Thank you to everyone who contributed and supported us during our KBOO Fights Back end of year campaign. With help from our community, we exceeded our $75,000 goal and will be able to continue bringing you grassroots independent community radio.
Radio in San Francisco. This is Flashpoints. I'm Dennis Bernstein. Today on the show, why is a U.S. citizen, Chantal Anoche, locked inside a military camp in the Philippines and unreachable by U.S. human rights activists? Also, Flashpoint senior producer Kevin Pina reports on that situation and follows up with some important information. We'll also broadcast the weekly edition of the Electronic Intifada newscast with Nora Barros Friedman, and we're going to introduce you to a new segment. We're going to be starting in just a little bit with Cynthia Papermaster and Code Pink. We're going to sort of do a news and action collaboration presentation. All that and more coming up. Stay tuned. Okay, you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. Got those marbles out of my mouth. I'm delighted now to welcome back to these airwaves a good friend of this show. Cynthia Papermaster is the Code Pink rep for the Bay Area. I don't know the exact technical presentation, but she's been with us many times, been out in the field, been on the air with us, really making us aware of all kinds of important information and action. Cynthia, welcome back to Flashpoints. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Dennis. My title right now is Code Pink Organizer for Code Pink Sonoma County, because I've moved up to Sonoma County.
Well, that's amazing. And you have another label, too. You're going to be sort of joining us here to do what we're calling, well, what are we calling this?
Pink Notes. I think we're going to call
Pink Notes. Pink Notes. And
I'm hoping, you know, oftentimes, Cynthia, I don't know if you know this, we're not allowed as producers on KPFA, on non-commercial radio, to say things like, come on down and, you know, direct support this. We can bring you the information. We can tell you what's happening. But other folks, that's why we have other folks on to sort of say, come on down. So... You know, we could have a beautiful collaboration, making note of the issues that are on the mind of Pink, Code Pink, and all of us usually, having to do with war and peace and resisting things like genocide and the ICE police. And in that spirit, I understand... you have information, some information for folks in the Bay Area, in the North Bay. Do you want to talk about what's going on?
Yeah, I'd love to. So, Code Pink Sonoma County is just getting organized, but we will be participating on Sunday in something called the Anti-Fascist Solidarity Social. And it features the brilliant singer-songwriter David Rogic, who's going to be in the Bay Area.
Yay. We'll see if we can get him on. That's for sure.
I hope you can. I hope you can.
Yeah.
David Rovix, and he's going to be at the Sebastopol Community Cultural Center from 4 to 8 p.m. on Sunday, and that's at 390 Morris Street in Sebastopol. It's a benefit for Project Hope for Palestine, which provides on-the-ground help for people in Gaza, and the group called UndocuFund for disaster relief in Sonoma County. People can make a donation at the door. No one will be turned away. And there'll be delicious Palestinian food, poetry, lots of music. The organizers are saying, come and have some fun and bring your dancing shoes. And we will have an information table at this event. So if you're in Sonoma County or you come to the event, give us your email and or get on our signal and hear about Code Pink actions that we're going to be organizing. Thanks for letting me announce that.
Oh, sure. I guess I wanted to sort of get your take, give you a minute or two to respond to stuff that's going on all around us. The thing that I couldn't get over today is the way in which ICE is now using young kids to sort of ring the doorbells of their own houses or whatever, knock, to bring their parents out so that they can arrest them all together. And this is getting more and more like what we learned about the way in which the Nazis acted, and now really the way in which the Israelis treat Palestinians. So we're watching this bubble up. Your thoughts?
Yeah, just it looks like the Gestapo. I mean, you see these videos, and no one is innocent in their eyes. If you're even there just filming them, they can arrest you, they can murder you, they seem to be getting away with this. And then today I hear the Congress passed a budget for ICE, and some Democrats joined with the Republicans to continue funding, even though there's a huge outcry in this country against funding ICE. So it's very scary. It's very, very upsetting every day. And I know you feel that way too.
Of course. I imagine this is reverberating through Code Pink in locally, as you're saying, the work that you're doing, and all across this country, people are alert. There's extraordinary, I'm cheering the extraordinary courage of Minneapolis, the whistleblowers, in the face of ICE's demonstration that they're willing to kill protesters, and the folks are still out in the street. These are the kinds of things we want to share with you with Code Pink, because we know these are this is where you all engage with the people. That's part of why we're loving the idea of hooking up. We're going to get back to you soon. Why don't you 30 seconds, give us for folks in the Bay Area, what do you want them to do?
I want them to come on Sunday to the Anti-Fascist Solidarity Social. with David Rovix at the Benefit for Project Hope for Palestine, and join us at 4 p.m. anytime between 4 and 8 at 390 Morris Street, Sebastopol Community Cultural Center in Sebastopol. Please come out and be in solidarity against this anti-fascist stuff that's going on. Thank you.
Thank you. All right, be safe now. And you are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Coming up next, we turn our attention back to an incredibly serious story taking place, playing out in the Philippines. It began on New Year's Day with a massacre, bombs dropped on an indigenous village in Mindoro that left 5 civilians dead. It has ended with a U.S. citizen, Chantel Anoche, locked inside a military camp. This is in the Philippines. She was taken, labeled as a rescue by the army, but treated like a prisoner of war. That's our information. Why is the Philippine military refusing to release her? And does the answer lie in the valuable mineral deposits directly beneath that bombed village? Tonight, we follow the money and the munitions. Here is senior producer Kevin Pina with this Flashpoint special investigation.
This is Kevin Pina for Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. This is a special investigative report. We're turning our eyes to the Philippines, where the new year began not with celebration, but with a massacre. On January 1st, 2026, the Philippine military launched an aerial bombardment on an indigenous community in Mindoro, killing 5 civilians. Among the survivors is Chantel Anicoche, a Filipino-American community leader who went missing during the attack and is now being held in military custody under highly suspicious circumstances. We're now joined by Ricky Pataxil. He's an organizer with Migrante Northern California, a Filipino migrant workers organization that fights for the rights and welfare of overseas Filipinos and for national freedom and genuine democracy in the Philippines. Also joining us is Pilar Castil, a mass campaigns officer of Bayan USA, a national chairperson of Gabriela USA. She was born and raised in Hayward and currently based in San Francisco, California. Pilar's been organizing with the National Democratic Movement of the Philippines since she was a student at San Francisco State University in 2011. Ricky and Pilar, welcome to Flashpoints.
Hi, thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having us.
Of course. Now, let's take a look at the timeline, because the dates tell a very different story than the Philippine military's press release. The bombing took place on January the 1st. The military didn't find Chantel until January the 8th, 8 full days later. They claim they rescued her only 500 meters from the bombing site. Does it make sense to you that it took over a week to find a survivor less than a half mile away in an area they'd already been patrolling since January the 2nd? Pilar, you want to take that?
Yes, I can. So from our analysis, it really does feel very suspicious. And so when the IFP was able to release videos of finding Chantel, they released it to major media in the Philippines, as well as online on Facebook. And so we were able to view some of these videos, and it's very suspicious in the ways that the officers or soldiers who are recording the videos already are starting to speak English, and then actually find her in a hole. And you hear her asking for help. And so when they are able to get to her, which is only like a few steps after the recording starts, they already start asking her questions in English and then identifying Chantel as Chantel. They have the flyers actually from Bayan USA from our initial statements on surfacing Chantel, which is what our call was earlier when we first heard that she had been in the area where the bombings was happening. And so it's very suspicious that they already had this flyer on their phones and that they were speaking English. And then they were able to give her a pair of slippers right away. They give her water. And there are several soldiers that are also speaking in English. And so it really does seem very staged. And also to have this footage in a way that can be shared out really paints their narration that they found her only 500 meters where the site of the bombings happened. But from the understanding of their reports as well is that after the bombings happened on the 1st of January, there were already clearing operations, meaning that they had been already looking in this area for potential hazards or anything like remnants from the operations that they conducted themselves.
And you're listening to Flashpoints. That's the voice of Pilar Castile. She's a mass campaigns officer of Bayan USA and the national chairperson of Gabriela USA. Well, Ricky, let's turn to you now. On January the 11th, the military released a sworn affidavit allegedly signed by Chantal stating she's voluntarily chosen to remain in custody at Camp Capimpin for medical treatment. Given that she'd been held incommunicado since January the 9th without access to her family or independent counsel, legal counsel, how much credence should we give to a legal document signed inside a military black site?
I think we can very much be suspicious of this document that was released. The AFP is actually notorious for forcing captives to sign on to documents to show that they have not been tortured or psychologically impacted by the operations of how the military conducts itself. You actually had evidence of organizers, environmental justice organizers, such as Jonila Castillo, who previously was held captive by the AFP, but upon exposing that they had tried to coerce them to sign on to similar documents, that it was exposed that the military was actively trying to coerce them. The military has also had different incidents of conducting psychological torture on captives that they have, who have been organizers who are fighting off against big multinational corporations that have been impeding on the land of indigenous peoples and have also land grabbed from rural communities in the Philippines.
Well, just to follow up, Ricky, now the 203rd Infantry Brigade of the AFP, that's the Army of the Philippines, dropped bombs on the village of Barangay Cabacao. I believe that's how you pronounce it. And we know that three children, Mangen children, and two student researchers were killed that morning. Let's talk a little bit more about the bombing. Can you tell us who these victims were and why the military targeted this specific indigenous community on New Year's Day?
Yeah, so for these specific communities in Mindoro, which is where these attacks had taken place, it has been a history of Mindoro itself as an island that has had an abundance of natural resources such as gold. And it has actually been the AFP that has worked alongside different corporations, such as the Intex Mindoro Nickel Project, which seeks to extract the nickel that's within the islands. We've also seen Peaceland Corporation, which is a development project that has been at the forefront of actually displacing these Mangyan indigenous peoples in the area. So while there's been active campaigns against the mining operations of companies such as the Intex Nickel Company, and then even with Peaceland Corporation, these indigenous folks have for a very long time tried to resist these operations. With the military coming in, the military is very much aiding these companies so that they can further extract the different resources that are there and to really cater to a lot of the foreign interests. We saw last year that for Marcos Jr., who's the current president of the Philippines, he's really trying to open up the Philippines to foreign investments. And part of what he's done is open up a policy that would allow foreign multinational companies to operate on a lease of 99 years. So what we're really seeing is an outright attack against the indigenous Mangyang communities who, within their ancestral domains, have refused to allow, up until now, these companies to come in to displace them. But because of the military really aiding these corporations to come in, that's where we start to see, such as with the bombings that had happened on the 1st of January, where we've seen 188 families from the Mangyang communities be displaced. This isn't anything new for a lot of the indigenous communities in the Philippines, but this is why we are also trying to raise up that these violations that are happening are part and parcel of a larger instance of opening up the Philippines for foreign investments.
And that's the voice of Ricky Pataxil. He's an organizer with Migrante Northern California. We're talking about the situation in the Philippines and a bombing that the Philippine military did upon an indigenous community in Mindoro. We're also talking about the kidnapping of Chantal Anicoche, who's been in military custody since January the 8th. And also joining us is Pilar Castile, the Mass Campaigns Officer of Bayan USA and the National Chairperson of Gabriela USA. Well, Pilar, the timing of this attack is kind of impossible to ignore, right? It's just 2 weeks before, on December the 17th, 2025, the U.S. Senate actually passed the Philippines Enhanced Resilience Act, known as the PERA, the PERA, authorizing $2.5 billion in military aid. Is it fair to say that the bombs dropped on January the 1st were effectively a down payment from the U.S. on this new aid package?
It is very not a coincidence, I think, to actually, we're seeing now the bombs dropping in Mindoro right after the signing of an increase in military financing for the Philippines from the U.S. And so that's also something that we really have to understand, and also understand as folks who are here based in the U.S., our tax money is actually going to funding these human rights violations in the Philippines, as well as in other countries where they're getting military support from the U.S. And so here in the Mindoro, we're seeing that there's continued military presence there. And it's not a coincidence either that they are also in areas where there are multinational corporations, like Ricky said earlier, the Peaceland Corporation, who's been using armed goons to actually prohibit the indigenous people, the Hmong indigenous people, from entering or leaving certain areas of their, which is what their ancestral domain. We also have seen other human rights violations that were committed by this corporation against the indigenous people, things like food blockades, illegal arrests. We've seen filing of fabricated cases. There's been gun pointing, firing of weapons, theft and slaughter of their livestock, and actual destruction of the indigenous people's crops, which for us understanding too that is really their livelihood. And so they also have been in violation of destruction of the houses of the indigenous people. There has been threats, harassment, intimidation, sexual harassment has been recorded, arrest of minors, as well as ongoing physical assault and violence. And In last October, I was actually able to go back to the Philippines on a solidarity mission. I went to the island of Negros, but we also had international delegates go to the island of Mindoro, actually in Abra de Ilog, which is the same area in which Chantal was disappeared from when they were separated from the rest of the folks that they were with in the communities. And so when we had international delegation in Mindoro, they actually also faced harassment. They faced surveillance by military forces, by the Philippine National Police. There was nothing that they were doing wrong. They were going to the indigenous communities to learn what the indigenous people's campaigns were, how is their everyday lives, what are the impacts of the environmental degradation that's happening there because of these different foreign mining operations. And so this is also not a surprise that there continues to be this militarization of the area and continues to be a repression on the indigenous peoples, but also on those that are supporting the indigenous peoples. And so people like Chantal, who actually are also put a target on them by the Philippine state. And so we're seeing that this is really a systematic repression of the rights and welfare of Filipinos who are really there to defend their lives and defend their ancestral land.
Well, Pilar, we have a U.S. citizen, Chantal Anicoche, who's been in military custody since January the 8th. As of today, January the 21st, has the U.S. Embassy or the State Department made any public move to secure her release? Or are they maintaining silence to protect that $2.5 billion security deal?
As of now, we've not heard any actual statements from the embassy. We've only been seeing these different statements actually coming from the armed forces of the Philippines or the Philippine military making these different claims, such as the one that we were talking about earlier with Ricky, that she had supposedly signed an affidavit, signed that she wants to stay in the custody so that she can get medical attention. And so all of these, of course, without having actual human rights advocates be able to be in touch with her directly, is very concerning. And so that's also one of the things that we really need to advocate for. And so we also have a advocacy aspect of our campaign to release Chantal, to really get more and more people to ask and to demand that there is some continued advocacy as well from our representatives here in the United States on her behalf, as she is a U.S. Citizen. She was a student at the university in Baltimore. She is an advocate and leader in her community, and there's so many people that just want to bring her home.
Well, for our listeners hearing this on January the 21st, Chantal's now been in custody for 13 days. Ricky, what is the immediate demand for the U.S. government, and who should people call to demand proof of life and Chantal's immediate release?
Yeah. So in regards to really pushing for the U.S. Congress, State Department, and the U.S. Embassy in Manila to invoke their diplomatic powers to pressure the Philippine government to immediately release Chantal Anicoche from the custody of the armed forces of the Philippines. Right now, what we're really pushing is this petition to get her released. And this is going out to particularly Ferdinand Marcos Jr., who's the president of the Philippines, Jose Romualdez, the ambassador of the Philippines to the United States, and then also calling on Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, and Mary Kay Carlson, who's the ambassador to the Philippines, to really take heed of this petition that we're pushing to get supporters to get Chantal back home so she can be here in the safety of her community, her family, and her friends.
Pilar, we're going to give you the last word.
Yes. It's really important for us right now to make noise, to make sure that Chantal Anicoche's name is recognized, that people continue to support and demand that she is released, and that she is also being able to be accessible. Something that is going on is that we actually have partners in the Philippines on the ground who are going to the camp to be able to meet her, to also understand what is her actual state right now, because that is also something that we've not been able to be privy to. We've only had these different statements coming from the armed forces of the Philippines, coming from the Philippine military. And so we really need to urge the U.S. embassy to also take matters into their hands and their responsibility to Chantal, to the people that are also demanding that she is safe and that she comes home safely and that she's able to continue to do the amazing work that she's been able to support her continue her learning and understanding and being with the Filipino community, not only in her hometown or where she's from in Baltimore, but also in the Philippines. And so we want to really make sure that anyone who wants to go and understand and learn more about their culture is able to do so safely and is able to do so without being a target, because really, activism is not a crime. It's not a crime to go home. And so we really urge everyone to be able to have that choice to do that, especially when we are really trying to learn more and help advocate for those who are unable to advocate for themselves. And so Chantal really decided to be a voice and to learn more. And so there's nothing wrong with that. And we urge everyone to continue to support endeavors like what Chantal's been able to do herself.
And again, our listeners can go to BayanUSA.org. That's BayanUSA.org, Bayan.org. And there is a petition there that the organization has put online that you can join and support Chantal. I want to thank you guys again. Again, that's Ricky Pataxil. He's an organizer with Migrante Northern California. And Pilar Castile, she's a mass campaigns officer of Bayan USA and national chairperson of Gabriela USA. Both of you, thank you so much for joining us today here on Flashpoints.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Here is the Electronic Intifada. We play it every week. It's the Electronic Intifada from Nora Barris Friedman. Listen.
This is the Electronic Intifada newscast. I'm Nora Barris Friedman, associate editor at the Electronic Intifada. It's day 839 of Israel's genocide in Gaza. Here's a brief summary of some of the latest developments this week in Palestine. Israel continues to kill and injure Palestinians across the Gaza Strip, while the Israeli blockade remains firmly in place despite more than 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon in October 2025.
On Wednesday, 11 Palestinians were killed and 6 were injured in a series of attacks on Gaza, including an airstrike targeting a vehicle carrying 3 journalists, all of whom were killed. Al Jazeera reported that Anas Ghanem, Abdul Rauf, and Shaath Mohammed Keshta were documenting developments on the ground in central Gaza near the so-called Netzarim corridor when an Israeli strike hit the car. A 4th person was also killed in the attack, an Al Jazeera team on the ground reported. Video footage by reporter Osama Kahlout showed the bombed out vehicle by the roadside, smoke still rising from the wreckage. The reporters worked for the Egyptian Committee for Gaza Relief, which supervises Egypt's relief work in Gaza, and were filming a newly established displacement camp. Israeli Army Radio, citing an Israeli security source, said that the Israeli Air Force had targeted a vehicle in central Gaza, claiming that its occupants were using a drone to collect intelligence on army forces. The Gaza government media office said that as of Wednesday, the number of reporters and media workers killed since the beginning of the genocide has now risen to 260. 5 other Palestinians were killed across Gaza on Wednesday, according to the Gaza Health Ministry, including in an Israeli attack in central Gaza, where 3 Palestinians, including a child, were killed in eastern Deir al-Balah. And in southern Gaza, a 13-year-old child, Motassem al-Sharafi, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers. Citing hospital staff, the Associated Press reported that the child was shot while collecting firewood in the eastern town of Bani Suhaila. Reporter Samer Al-Boji recorded footage of Mutassim's family grieving over his body, their hands and faces covered in their child's blood. On Monday, January 19th, a 17-year-old boy, Hussein Abu Sabla, was shot and killed by Israeli soldiers in eastern Khan Yunis. Israeli soldiers shot and injured several children this week. Faris Afana, the director of emergency and medical services in Gaza, reported that a 14-year-old girl was among a group of people wounded by random Israeli sniper fire that targeted tents for displaced families in northern Gaza on Tuesday. Afana said that emergency crews operating with severely limited capacity and damaged ambulances transported 4 injured people using the only functioning emergency vehicle in the north, including 2 in critical condition from the Beit Lahia area, and later evacuated 2 more overnight, one of them, the 14-year-old girl, to hospitals in Gaza City. Israeli gunfire injured a Palestinian child sheltering at the Halawa School in Jabalia in northern Gaza on January 17th. Wafa News Agency said that the attack coincided with airstrikes east of Gaza City, as well as shelling of Deir al-Balah and Al Burej refugee camp. Gunfire from Israeli military vehicles also resumed east of Khan Yunis and north of Rafah. In a statement on the passing of 100 days since the so-called ceasefire was agreed upon, the Gaza government media office affirmed on Tuesday that Israel has violated the agreement approximately 1,300 times and that nearly 500 Palestinians have been killed. Among the violations were 430 shootings, 66 incursions by vehicles into neighborhoods and residential areas, 604 bombings and targeted attacks, and 200 demolitions of houses and various buildings. Israel's compliance rate for the amount of aid and commercial trucks is around just 43%. Only 13% of the necessary amount of fuel trucks have entered Gaza to operate bakeries, vehicles, and generators. At least 2 children have died due to hypothermia as Israel's blockade on proper shelters and caravans remains in place with no end in sight. Last week, the Gaza government media office reported that 127,000 of the 135,000 tents in displacement camps have been rendered unusable because of the recent extreme weather. Al Jazeera's Tariq Abu Hazoum told the network on Monday that, quote, hundreds of thousands of displaced families are still living in torn tents and roofless homes exposed to the rain and cold and the freezing nights. On January 20th, a seven-month-old child, Shatha Abu Jarad, died due to the severe drop in temperatures in Gaza, according to Mahmoud Basal, the spokesperson for the Palestinian Civil Defense. Basal warned that thousands of children remain at serious risk as the Israeli occupation, backed by the United States, continues to block the entry of caravans, safe shelters, heating supplies, and sustainable construction materials, forcing families to survive winter inside torn tents with no protection. Basal said that these deaths are preventable and called for immediate international action before more children lose their lives. On January 17th, a four-week-old infant, Aisha Ayesh Al-Agha, died from hypothermia in Khan Yunis. As Israel continued its attacks across Gaza, the Israeli army dropped leaflets onto the tents of dozens of displaced families in Bani Suhaila, east of Khan Yunis, earlier this week, ordering Palestinians to leave. A resident from the Bani Suhaila area said that the expulsion orders impact at least 70 families living in tents and homes, some of which are partially damaged. Quote, "We have fled the area and relocated westward. It is maybe the fourth or fifth time the occupation expanded the yellow line since last month," the man told the Reuters news agency by phone from Khan Yunis. "Each time they move it around 120 to 150 meters inside the Palestinian-controlled territory, swallowing more land," he said. Ismail Al-Tawabta, director of the Gaza government media office, told Reuters that the Israeli military had expanded the area under its control in eastern Khan Yunis five times since the ceasefire, forcing the displacement of at least 9,000 people. Quote, "On Monday, January 19th, 2026, the Israeli occupation forces dropped warning leaflets demanding the forced evacuation of the Bani Suhaila area in eastern Khan Yunis governorate, in a measure that falls within a policy of intimidation and pressure on civilians," the Webta said. Meanwhile, the research agency Forensic Architecture released a detailed analysis of Israel's military movements in Rafah, in southern Gaza, which suggests that Israel is, quote, "beginning to build infrastructure which may be used to house Palestinians and effectively contain them in an area under full Israeli military control." Forensic Architecture says that the Israeli military is currently busy raising a strategic area of Rafah, compacting the ground and clearing rubble in a way that could be in preparation for construction of a so-called humanitarian city, or, as we've reported before, concentration camps. The area of interest, the group says, quote, "is half a kilometer into Israel's area of control, bound by two military corridors and near the camp of the Israeli-affiliated counterterrorism strike force, several military outposts, and the former Gaza Humanitarian Foundation sites. This environment suggests supervision and control rather than humanitarianism," Forensic Architecture said. Euromed Human Rights Monitor, in a report released earlier this month, warned that the so-called Green City Plan, quote, "entrenches a reality of prolonged, unlawful control, de facto annexation of land by force, and the imposition of unlawful forms of collective confinement of civilians, in clear violation of international law and the Palestinian people's right to self-determination." The area designated for the new city is currently under Israeli military control and hosts armed militias created by Israel, militias that have been proven to be involved in killings, intimidation, and theft against Palestinians, raising serious questions about their role in the emerging landscape being prepared in the area, Euromed says. In early December, details were disclosed regarding the U.S. plan for the Gaza Strip, developed through the U.S. Civil Military Coordination Center. The plan is based on establishing a rigid system of geographic segregation that divides Gaza into population blocks and closed military zones. Under this framework, more than half of the Gaza Strip is effectively placed within a closed military zone under direct Israeli army control, where strict systems of surveillance and military administration are imposed, Euromed states. A coercive environment is enforced, characterized by restrictions on movement, control over aid and essential services, and deprivation of a range of fundamental rights. These measures are used as pressure tools to push residents to leave their original places of residence and forcibly relocate to designated areas labeled safe within the closed military zone without being granted any genuine choice to remain or to return home, the group says. Turning to the occupied West Bank, Israeli forces shot and killed a child, 15-year-old Mohammed Saad Sami Nassan, in the village of Al-Mughayr on January 16th. Defense for Children International Palestine reports that Mohammed was shot in the chest by Israeli soldiers while Palestinian worshippers were exiting the Eastern Mosque in the village. The Israeli forces shot tear gas canisters and stun grenades as worshippers exited the mosque after noon prayers. Palestinian youth threw stones toward the soldiers, and the soldiers, who were on foot, opened fire and shot Mohammed in the chest from no more than 20 meters, or about 65 feet away. Mohammed was transported in a private vehicle first to the health center in Abu Falah, then to the Ramallah Medical Complex, where he was pronounced dead on arrival. Israeli forces had been routinely harassing Palestinian worshippers on Fridays at the Eastern Mosque in Al-Mughayr for weeks. Thousands of residents of the village joined a funeral procession for Mohammed on Saturday. In an escalation of routine attacks on UNRWA, the United Nations Agency for Palestine Refugees, Israeli forces used bulldozers and other heavy machinery to destroy the UNRWA headquarters in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of occupied East Jerusalem on Tuesday. Israeli forces, accompanied by bulldozers, raided the UNRWA headquarters and began demolishing structures inside the compound in the presence and under the supervision of Israeli National Security Minister Itamar Ben-Gvir. In an explicit expression of political support for the destruction and undermining of a UN organization, Ben-Gvir described the events as, quote, a historic day, a day of celebration, and a day of great importance for governing Jerusalem for many years to come, Euromed Human Rights Monitor said. Ben-Gvir called UNRWA, quote, supporters of terrorism, saying that, quote, today they are being expelled from here along with everything they built. This is what will happen to anyone who supports terrorism. The demolition and accompanying statements constitute a deliberate attempt to recast UNRWA from a UN agency protected by international immunity into an enemy stripped of legitimacy through accusations of terrorism, Euromed stated. Quote, this paves the way for normalizing attacks against the agency and any independent international presence while testing the limits of international deterrence and seeking to establish a precedent that UN immunity can be violated without consequence. In Jerusalem, the act carries an explicit assertion of sovereignty aimed at entrenching de facto annexation by eliminating any UN presence that reminds the world of the city's status as occupied territory and of the refugee issue and their rights. Roland Friedrich, the agency's West Bank director, said UNRWA received word that demolition crews and police arrived at their East Jerusalem headquarters earlier on Tuesday. Staff have not operated out of the facility for almost a year out of safety concerns, but Israeli forces confiscated devices and forced out private security guards protecting the facility, according to a report by the Associated Press. Quote, what we saw today is the culmination of 2 years of incitement and measures against UNRWA in East Jerusalem, Friedrich said. UNRWA chief Philippe Lazzarini said the attack came, quote, in the wake of other steps taken by Israeli authorities to erase the Palestine refugee identity. He also warned that what happens today to UNRWA will happen tomorrow to any other international organization or diplomatic mission anywhere in the world. An Israeli politician, Yulia Malinovsky, posed for a photo in front of the rubble of UNRWA's headquarters, celebrating and bragging about its demolition. Malinovsky, born in Ukraine, is a member of Avigdor Lieberman's far-right Yisrael Beiteinu party and the co-author of the 2024 bill that designated the Agency for Palestine Refugees as, quote, a terrorist organization. Later on Tuesday, Israeli forces fired tear gas at a Palestinian trade school in a second targeting of a UN facility in occupied East Jerusalem, Al Jazeera noted. The attack on the UNRWA compound followed last week's raid on and forced closure of the agency's oldest health clinic inside the Old City of Jerusalem last week. Israeli forces are planning to cut water and electricity services to all UNRWA locations across Palestine. Likud Minister Eli Cohen said he sent formal requests to the power and water companies, ordering them to carry out the shutdown. Meanwhile, Israeli settlers rampaged the small Palestinian Bedouin village of Hirbet Khalat al-Sidra, northeast of Jerusalem, on January 18th. Video footage shows homes and vehicles bursting into flames at night. Several Palestinians were injured in the attack. And in a report for the Electronic Intifada, journalist Zeina Tahan investigated plans for a new wall that the Israeli military is building deep inside the occupied West Bank. The wall, which is 22 kilometers long and 50 meters wide, includes an off-limits military-only road, quote, a project that will cut Palestinian landowners off from millions of square meters of their lands, displace Palestinian farming communities whose buildings will be demolished, and further sever movement between parts of the northern occupied West Bank. Tahan adds that, quote, in late November and early December 2025, Israeli forces began issuing dozens of demolition orders for homes, farms, greenhouses, livestock pens, water networks, and other structures along the planned route of the new segment of the wall in northern Jordan Valley. Countless Palestinians and their families living off these lands, whether landowners or employed workers, will be severely affected. Abdullah Abu Rahmeh, Director General of the Popular Action Department at the Wall and Settlement Resistance Commission, told the Electronic Intifada that, quote, the wall will isolate large swaths of privately owned, very fertile land. We are talking about some 190 to 200 square kilometers of land that will end up on the other side of the wall. For much more, read Zeina Tahan's report, New Wall Threatens Thousands of Palestinian Families, on electronicintifada.net. As we reported a few weeks ago, the Israeli military announced plans to demolish a children's soccer field in the Aida refugee camp in Bethlehem in the occupied West Bank. A global support campaign paired with political pressure on international professional football figures this week forced the Israelis to suspend the demolition. Beloved children's television entertainer Ms. Rachel lent her support to the children in Aida camp, speaking with them recently and hearing their stories about their fight to save their field and how they deserve to play and be safe.
It's Miss Rachel. I'm so happy to see you in your beautiful soccer field. We are going to do everything we can to help save the field and that every child has the right to play soccer and that you deserve to have your wonderful field.
احنا ما بدنا يهدموا ملعبنا وبدنا نلعب بامان لان هذا حلمنا
شكرا انك تضامنتي معنا احنا بنحبك كثير
لما شفتك واقفه معنا شعرت اننا مش لحالنا واحنا بنحب نوصل صوتنا لكل العالم
والملعب كثير مهم لنا لانه بنلاقي فيه اصدقائنا اللي بنحبهم وبنلعب معهم
شكرا انك واقفه معنا
We are so sad about what's happening in the field and what's happening in the camp. Thank you for supporting us and standing with us. And thank you so much. We love you.
I am so proud to be one of the people supporting you. And I know we've heard from some really, really big things are happening. And I really believe in my heart that the field will be saved. Anna Behebek.
Ms. Rachel stated on her Instagram, along with that video, quote, it was an honor to listen to them and hear how much it means to them that the world is rallying around them. The people hear them and the people know what is right and what is wrong. Taking joy from kids is wrong. Dehumanizing kids is wrong. Saying some kids get to play and some don't is wrong. Listen to the children. On Tuesday, it was reported that the president of FIFA, the International Soccer Federation, along with his European counterpart, intervened, suspending the field's demolition at least for the time being, with the final decision now resting with the Israeli government. Mohamed Abu Sror, the director of the youth center at the Aida pitch, told The Athletic that, quote, "This is a huge success for the campaign, but we are still concerned about what could be the final political decision of the matter. We still haven't received official confirmation from the army." Here is Mohamed Abu Sror on Tuesday.
I think it is just news till now. We did not have any official papers or decisions that reached us through our lawyer or through any letter from the FIFA or the European Federation for Football, the UEFA. I would say that we will be so happy if this intervention stops demolishing our playground. Our campaign would continue. We will continue our campaign to stop demolishing our playground. But till now, we are asking the FIFA or the UEFA to send us an official letter that the Israeli occupation would freeze or stop demolishing our playground.
Following the news that the soccer field would not be demolished, Ms. Rachel posted a follow-up video for the kids in Aida camp.
You saved the soccer field. I want to say the biggest congratulations ever to the kids at Aida camp and the grown-ups there. They got this petition going. They got 350,000 signatures. They created a challenge for people to do with 10 kick ups or something. I'm sorry, I'm not the best at sports, but I know so many people commented, shared, signed the petition. When people come together, they can make amazing things happen, because we all know what's right and wrong. And why would you destroy something that means so much to kids who have been through so much already? It just doesn't make any sense, and we all know it doesn't make sense, and we all came together. So everyone coming together caused FIFA and UEFA to intervene, and the Israeli government is now not going to destroy the soccer field. I'm just so proud of everyone and the kids. You did it. I'm so proud of you. And it was so wonderful meeting you the other day on the Zoom call.
That was Miss Rachel. It is certainly good news for Aida camp and its children, but as our colleague Abu Bakr Abed commented, Palestinians in Gaza have been screaming at the top of their lungs to the same sports bodies to take any boycott actions against Israeli teams and to stop the annihilation of the people in Gaza, including more than 800 athletes and the destruction of hundreds of sports facilities. They have so far been met with silence. The Israeli human rights group B'Tselem released a new report this week titled Living Hell, which further documents the rampant abuse and torture of Palestinians inside Israeli prison camps. B'Tselem says, quote, "Israeli prisons continue to function as a network of torture camps for Palestinians, with the systematic abuse even more extensive than before. This includes physical and psychological abuse, inhumane conditions, deliberate starvation, and denial of medical care, all of which has led to numerous deaths. Some witnesses also described undergoing or witnessing sexual violence and abuse. The transformation of prisons into a network of torture camps is part of the Israeli regime's coordinated onslaught on Palestinian society aimed at dismantling the Palestinian collective." Some of the report's findings detail the use by Israeli prison guards and doctors of extremely graphic sexual torture with objects and dogs, as well as psychological violence. We've published many features in the last week, but we wanted to highlight Winter Strikes with a Vengeance by Fida Al-Kadra, writing from Gaza. In a crammed tent, flooded with water and torn by the wind, by the seaside in Mawasi, Khan Yunis, Yad Abu Jamia, 49, is trying to support his and his son's family, a total of 14 people, Al-Kadra writes. Around him, tents sit cheek by cheek as displaced families face the bitter winter cold with no proper shelter, while rain and sewage flood their homes, creating harsh and unsanitary living conditions. Abu Jamia and his family were displaced from the Al Zana area on the eastern side of Khan Yunis. In fact, he told the Electronic Intifada that since the beginning of Israel's genocide in Gaza, they had been displaced more than 20 times. Every time we took this dilapidated tent with us, for a year and a half, we have been trying to repair it and keep it standing. During a recent cold spell, when a storm hit Gaza, the tent collapsed. Quote, the tent was uprooted and the fabric torn apart. I received 3 nylon sheets from UNRWA and built a new tent in preparation for winter weather, but rainwater flooded it while we were sleeping. The family sought shelter in a neighbor's tent. The next morning, we tried to fix what was ruined, he said. All around him, the family's possessions, mattresses, and clothes were spread out on the beach to dry. They had managed to repair some tears in the tent, but it was ad hoc work. They need help as winter deepens, Abu Jamia said. That, however, is yet to come. Gaza's 2 million people need assistance to provide decent shelters as winter deepens. Already, several people, among them children and at least 4 babies, have died as a result of cold weather and inadequate shelters. But international organizations are themselves dependent on Israel to open crossings, and Israel continues to block or delay the delivery of aid and humanitarian goods, including tents. Even the UK was moved to protest in December that tents it had supplied were delayed for over a year.
You're tuned in to listener-supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
I'm Doug McVeigh, host of Free Culture Radio. Every month, we bring you 30 minutes of news and information about people who use drugs, as we discuss topics like safe supply, safe consumption spaces, decriminalization, legalization, harm reduction.